We're on page 24 of our notes. Anybody need, anybody remember Ezekiel? No, it's been a little while. But Ezekiel 17 tonight. And we have parables here. So Jesus did not invent the parable, right? Sometimes we mistakenly think so. Jesus was just using an already existing method of illustration, right? So we have here the two eagles, and we have this vine, which we have seen before in earlier chapters, and it is a common illustration because there's vines everywhere in Israel, right? It seems like everywhere you go, there's a vine growing somewhere, and these eagles, just they're not the same types, same, what do you call it, variety or same, they don't look like American bald eagles, okay, but they're still classified as eagles, so don't think of some white-headed eagle, right, just, they're just eagles. But the point is that God gives to Israel through Ezekiel this parable, and in verses 1 through 10, he gives these two aspects to this parable, and then because he knows they are spiritual, technical term, doofuses, they are, he then gives them the explanation, right? Says, oh, by the way, did you not get that? Okay. Here's what it means, right? So, verses 1 through 10 give us the need for the interpretation. It, as I've typed in there, it's going to give us the political background to all that's taking place as Babylon comes in waves to attack Jerusalem in 605 and 597 and 586. And all that transpires with that, but Ezekiel has been covering what's been taking place in the hearts of the average person, what's been taking place in the heart of the religious leadership. Now he gives us what's been happening in the heart of the politicians. And so what you'll learn this evening is that politicians have always been politicians, right? We do not have a corner on that market, right? There have been bad politicians seemingly forever. So verses 1 through 6 give to us the first eagle, which is, shall we say, active or aggressive. And I think you'll be able to think this through. Verse 1 says, the word of Yahweh came to me, saying, Son of man, propound a riddle and speak a parable to the house of Israel. And you will say, thus says Adonai Yahweh. A great eagle with great wings, long pinions, and a full plumage of many colors came to Lebanon and took away the top of the cedar. And he plucked off the topmost of its young twigs and brought it to a land of merchants. He set it in a city of traders. He also took some of the seed of the land and planted it in a field fit for seed. He placed it beside abundant waters. He set it like a willow. Then it sprouted and became a low-spreading vine with its foliage turned toward him, but its roots remained under it. So it became a vine and yielded shoots and sent out branches. Now again, all parables, you need to remember this with all parables, is not, parables are not designed to stand on all four legs, right, so to speak. Not everything means something equally important, okay? The parable is to get across a primary story, right? And we want to look for that, what is that underlying message that Jesus is, that Yahweh is getting across here. So the eagle seems to be King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, and we can compare that with chapter 17 and verse 12, because it says, behold, the king of Babylon came to Jerusalem. I think that's a pretty safe interpretation, okay? think we're on safe ground here. The Lebanon, curiously enough, is not Lebanon, right? This is a parable, so Yahweh can make his, he can use his words as we've seen earlier in chapter 16, and these illustrations of the woman and of the sisters. So Lebanon is used here to refer to Jerusalem. Now that's an insult. Some would argue it's an insult to Jerusalem. The people of Lebanon would probably say it's an insult to them that it's referenced, that it's Jerusalem. Because Jerusalem is really bad, right, at this point. The cedar tree is David's dynasty, or if you're from Europe, a dynasty. The top of the cedar is King Jehoiakim. The land of the merchants and the city of traders is Babylon, and the spreading vine is Jehoiakim's uncle Zedekiah. Now, that's going to all be interpreted for us again, but the point is this. This is Nebuchadnezzar. And Nebuchadnezzar's coming, and he's going to wreak havoc for the people of Israel. And their leadership is going to be taken away. Well, secondly, in verses 7 through 10, there's a more, shall we say, passive eagle, a less impressive eagle, and there's the uncertain future of this vine. And this eagle seems to be a pharaoh. Now, it's he is sometimes known as Pharaoh Apries, sometimes known as Pharaoh Hophra, but the point is, it's an Egyptian king. So again, Israel sits between. Israel has forever been this political football, right? And you can reference that as a European football instead of an American football, if you will. But either way, Israel has always been kicked around by the bullies of the Middle East, right? Whether they come from the north or whether they come from the south. Israel gets bounced back and forth, and that's what is referenced here. It says, there was another great eagle with great wings and much plumage, and behold, this vine bent its roots toward him and sent out its foliage up toward him from the beds where it was planted, that he might water it. It was planted in a good field beside abundant waters, that it might yield branches and bear fruit and become a majestic vine. I mean, that's its purpose. I mean, who plants a vine and for it to be less than majestic, right? I hope this is just really mediocre, right? Everybody plants their flower beds that way, right? The National Association of Lowered Expectations, right? Or whatever that was, right? Have an adequate birthday thing. So, say, thus says Adonai Yahweh, will it succeed? Will he not pull up its roots and cut off its fruit so that it dries up, so that all its sprouting leaves dry up? And neither by great strength nor by many people can it be raised from its roots again. And behold, though it is planted, will it succeed? Will it not completely dry up as soon as the east wind strikes it? Dry up on the beds where it sprouted. So here we have this Pharaoh coming up from Egypt, and God had, again, with the interpretation coming up in a few short verses here, remember that God has said to Israel again and again, do not appeal to Egypt, right? I pulled you out of Egypt back in the time of Moses, don't go back there. And what does Israel do? Yeah. We all have habits. Nations have habits. Right? Politicians have habits. And Israel is going to do the same thing. So when Mattaniah or Zedekiah was, while he was initially loyal to Nebuchadnezzar, he eventually reaches out for help to Egypt, and he wants to play the one against the other. Okay? Politicians can never have too many friends, right? That's the mindset. Now, his rebellion by going and appealing to Egypt is what brings about the wrath of Nebuchadnezzar. Okay? And he, I mean, Nebuchadnezzar, yes, came, and you can read about this. I've given you the references there in 2 Kings 24 and 2 Chronicles 14 and Jeremiah. But Nebuchadnezzar, overall, though while he did destroy Jerusalem and the temple, but he still took care of Daniel, for instance, right? Daniel and his friends. He took care of a lot of them and yes, merged them into their culture, but he didn't annihilate them, right? It wasn't like the Assyrians, right? So Nebuchadnezzar was, yes, he was powerful, and yes, he was at times violent, but he also treated many of them with appropriate respect, okay? Well, they responded to that decency, if you will, of the conquering king by appealing to somebody else, which infuriates him, and he comes back and spanks them again, if you will. Now, the withered vine that we have read about here has already been looked at in chapter 15. It's also referenced, I believe it's Isaiah 5. But instead of accepting his generosity and kindness, Zedekiah rejects fruitfulness and embraces vulnerability. I would rather find my own comfort my own way than the comfort that God offers to me freely. Okay? How often we do that. And we're all guilty of that in different ways. Now, God often takes us through some extremely difficult things, but we know that he is still a God of compassion, a God of grace, a God of kindness. And we lose perspective in the midst of the suffering at times. And Zedekiah, I don't think there's anyone who argues that Zedekiah is a genuinely born-again individual. He just seems to be just an unbeliever who is connected to the royal family in some way and just absolutely makes foolish decisions. Ezekiel's two groups of questions, that first group in verse 9, expect a negative answer. Will it succeed? Nah. No. Ain't gonna happen. And then his second group of questions anticipate a positive answer. Will it, though it is planted, will it succeed? Will it not completely dry up as soon as the east wind strikes it? Well, yeah, it will. And that strong, hot, dry wind comes off of the Arabian desert and sucks all the moisture out of everything on its way toward the Mediterranean. And I have never personally seen it, but what I have read is you can have a nice green whatever in the morning. And if that wind blows all day from the east, whatever it is that you had that was so luxuriously green is now brown. It'll suck all the moisture out in a day. Okay? So that it will dry up on the beds where it sprouted. So the interpretation here real quickly, verses 11 through 21. God doesn't have to interpret the parable, right? We've been listening to Pastor MacArthur's his recent series on the podcast of the parables. And the parables were intended to obscure things, right, as a rule of thumb, right? And so God doesn't have to give them an explanation, but he does. And that's grace, and we need to acknowledge that. But Israel's sinful leadership, their sinful relationships with Babylon and with Egypt, they deserve, and the point again is they're going to get what they deserve. Moreover, verse 11, the word of Yahweh came to me saying, say now to the rebellious house. And I've given you the other references where that is found in the book of Ezekiel. Do you not know what these things mean? Yeah, he's getting him, trying to get them to think. say, behold, the king of Babylon came to Jerusalem, took its king and princes, and brought them to him in Babylon. And he took one of the royal seed and cut a covenant with him and brought him under oath. He also took away the dominant one of the land, that the kingdom might become lowly, not lifting itself up, but keeping his covenant that it might continue. And again, that was just a typical military and political strategy, was to remove leadership from the country, which is why Daniel and his friends were taken, because they were the cream of the crop. And they're naturally going to take over the leadership of the nation. So the Babylonians said, well, let's take all of them out there. So what's left is just the common person, right? So that was their strategy. He didn't want them to rise up in rebellion against him. Let's keep them stupid. Let's keep them without any type of potential leadership. Verse 15 tells us, but he rebelled, right? Jehoiakim's submission, but Zedekiah rebels. But he rebelled against him by sending his messengers to Egypt that they might give him horses and many troops. Right? You always got to be wondering here about getting military help from other nations. That opens up a whole can of worms for contemporary America. But you got to think about that. Why are we looking for those? Why are we looking for them? Will he succeed? Will he who does such things escape? Can he indeed break the covenant and escape? As I live, declares Adonai Yahweh, surely in the country of the king who made him king, whose oath he despised and whose covenant he broke in Babylon, he shall die. So Zedekiah's rebellion against Nebuchadnezzar and the consequences of that. Again, you think of those terms that are used here, despising the oath, breaking the covenant. Doesn't that sound familiar? Not just on the political side of things, but especially on the religious side of things. Isn't this what Israel has done to Yahweh? Again and again and again and again. And now it's happening politically. And Pharaoh, with his mighty military force and great assembly, will not help him in the war when they cast up ramps and build siege walls to cut off many lives. Verse 18. Now he despised the oath by breaking the covenant. And behold, he pledged his allegiance, yet did all these things. He shall not escape. Therefore, thus says Adonai Yahweh, as I live, surely my oath, which he despised, and my covenant, which he broke, I will put on his head, and I will spread my net over him, and he will be caught in my snare. And then I will bring him to Babylon and enter into judgment with him there regarding the unfaithful act which he has committed against me. All the choice men and all his troops will fall by the sword, and the remnant will be scattered to every wind, and you will know that I, Yahweh, have spoken. So, who brought him to Babylon? Nebuchadnezzar. Who brought him to Babylon? Yahweh did, right? God uses human instruments to accomplish his purpose, and we need to, again, you have to keep that in perspective, and we've used the illustration, rightfully so, so many times of who killed Jesus. Who put Jesus to death? Well, did the Jews? Yeah, yeah. Did the Romans? Yeah. Did Pilate? Yes. Did you and me? Yes. Did God? according to Isaiah 52 and 53. Yeah, God the Father did. So there are many layers of responsibility, right? And we can't eliminate them, but we need to understand them, right? And what God is saying to them, yes, it might have been Nebuchadnezzar, it might have been the Babylonians that were the human instrument in all of this, but who brought you to Babylon? Yahweh. You broke his covenant, he will bring your punishment. Okay. Which leads us then, if we can, to verses 22 through 24. Yes. He was doing what Babylonians did. I mean, he was the grand poobah of the world at the time. No one's going to argue with him, right? He's the military force. He is, well, as you see in the book of Daniel, he is the one who made the great Babylon, you know, the city of Babylon, right? Very, apparently very efficient, very effective, just doing what an unbeliever politician would do. Good for Babylon. Yeah. I mean, it was, he brought a lot of good things, similar to Herod the Great, right, in the land of Israel. He built a temple. You know, need a temple. Probably don't need one quite like that, but he made one, right? God used him, even though he wasn't necessarily looking forward to being used by God to do that. He wanted the glory to Herod. You know, that's the way the Herods. And Nebuchadnezzar was that way until God got his attention. And I think he becomes a genuine believer in chapter 4 of Daniel. So these... I'm thinking of Cyrus, and trying to remember the chapter in Isaiah where God refers to Cyrus as my anointed, my Messiah. No, not Messiah with a capital M, Messiah with a little m, right? My anointed one. Even Cyrus, who is an unbeliever, is still God's chosen instrument to accomplish something in God's eternal purpose. Now, they're still responsible for their sin. Just as Pilate or Caiaphas and Annas, the high priests, in their quest to stomp Jesus and to remove his influence, yes, they were guilty, but yes, they still accomplished God's plan. So, again, balancing that, not just layers of responsibility, but balancing God's sovereignty and human responsibility. Right? So, all right, any other before we go on? Yes. Right. And Daniel 2, where the outline of human history is given there, and the future kingdoms that come in, that's all a revelation of God's sovereignty over the affairs of men. Right. God establishes the boundaries of every nation. God establishes the leadership. He is the one who raises up leaders, and he is the one who tears down leaders, right? So it's not just the CIA, so to speak, of, you know, from the 60s, remember? Wow, you know, American history is pretty bleak at times, but the infiltration of various... U.S. intelligence groups in the affairs of other nations has not been good. Okay? We have a lot to answer for, and they have a lot to answer for because we were ignorant of it and weren't aware. But God is the one who raises them up, right? Just as he does. And again, as Americans, we wrestle with that because why? We voted. Right? Well, yeah, you voted. But ultimately, who put your king on the throne? Right? Which is why, again, backing up in American history, which is why there were those in the pre-revolutionary days who were strongly reminding people, don't fight against the king because the king is there by God's design. And they were trying to bring caution to people's thinking, lest people be fighting against God's appointed ruler for that time, and yet balancing that out with the king is doing sinful things and we need to hold the king accountable because the law is king, the king is not the law, right? Balancing that out. Even the king is accountable to something outside the king. So that's a difficult thing to keep in perspective, as I said, especially for us as Americans who think that we can. And we do vote people into positions of leadership and decision makers. And yet, isn't that why we as American Christians should be praying as we're voting? Right? Praying for wisdom and not just the person we like a little bit more than the person we really dislike. Right? Or the person who we dislike less. I mean, sometimes, isn't that what it feels like? You're left to, you know,
Yes.
Yes. Yes. It is. It is, and keeping perspective, and that's, I think this passage will help us as we wrap this up, if we can. Verses 22 through 24, then, the promise of Israel's restoration. Thus says Adonai Yahweh, and again, the sovereign Yahweh, right? That's Adonai. I will also take, this translation says, a sprig from the lofty top, or I will take from the lofty top. So a sprig is just a small portion from the lofty top of the cedar and set it out. I will pluck from the topmost of its young twigs a tender one, and I will plant it on an exalted and lofty mountain. On the high mountain of Israel, I will plant it that it may lift up boughs and yield fruit and become a majestic cedar, and birds of every kind will dwell under it. They will dwell in the shade of its branches. And then this wonderful promise, and all the trees of the field will know that I am Yahweh. Now again, do trees have, right? We're still in the parable mode here, right? You're still in figures of speech. Though I have met some people who would maybe make an argument for intelligent tree life, maybe. But all the trees of the field will know that I am Yahweh, and I will bring down the exalted tree, exalt the low tree, dry up the green tree, and make the dry tree flourish. In other words, I'm going to reverse things and set it the way I want it. Why? I am Yahweh. I have spoken, and I will do it. Right? And again, this is I would say, a somewhat watered-down version of what Nebuchadnezzar says in chapter 4 of Daniel, is, who can argue with God, right? Who can stop God's purpose? And so if God has spoken, will God do what he says he'll do? Well, but I... will God accomplish his purpose? So, Adonai Yahweh reveals himself as the ultimate power behind the first eagle. The top of this cedar in this context is a person, namely Messiah, Jesus, and I've given you references for that. This prophecy has not yet been fulfilled. Okay? We're waiting for the fulfillment of this. Of the chapters 14 through 18, this message is the only one that closes with, I am Yahweh, I have spoken, I will do it. So you get the idea that this is emphatic, okay, when it stands all by itself. I've given you the expression, declares Adonai Yahweh, is found, all of those different uses. It's interesting to see. And lastly, letter B under here, contrary to the experiences of Israel, Yahweh has not forgotten his covenant with David. Yeah, but we're in Babylon, and life is hard, and therefore God has forgotten. No. Right? Just because your experiences are uncomfortable doesn't mean that God has forgotten. And again, 2 Corinthians, the first chapter of 2 Corinthians, right? Isn't he the Father of mercies and the God of all comfort? Which assumes then that mercy and comfort will be expressed. But in order for it to be expressed, what? There needs to be misery, right? There needs to be discomfort. There needs to be unpleasantness. There needs to be difficulty for him to express those things to us. Now, Daniel Block reminds us of four things. I thought these were very, very helpful principles. First of all, people's response to crises must accord with the causes and not merely the symptoms of the crises. In other words, what? You need to deal with your sin, not just the unpleasant consequences of your sin. Right? Yeah, but if we could just get everybody out of Babylon, Babylon's not the problem. Right? Your exile is not the problem. It's your sin. You got to deal with that. Babylon's come and go, right? Isn't that what the book of Daniel is telling us? Babylon, whether it's Babylon or the Medes and the Persians or the Assyrians or the Greeks or the Romans, doesn't matter. Empires come and go. In fact, some empires have come and gone, and people think when you read certain things historically, well, those things, that's just not true. And then archaeologists are digging out in somebody's sandbox and they go, oh, look at here, right? Oh, after all, that was true, I guess, after all, right? We forget some of these empires that existed and flourished. Empires come and go, but God's people need to address the root cause and not the symptoms. Right? If you will, you can compare this with all the rain, right? Some people maybe have had water in their basement. Okay? So what do you do about it? Well, you can keep vacuuming. Okay? That's one, and you're just dealing with the symptoms, right? But you have a really nice vacuum. Boy, my vacuum, I can suck up a lot of water out of my basement. Well, but why do you have water in your basement? Okay. And there could be a variety of reasons for that, right? You might have an underground spring like we have in the southwest corner of the parsonage. Why that sump pump runs all the time. Or maybe your rain gutters aren't hooked up. Right? So your water is just, or maybe your landscaping is such that your yard slopes towards your foundation. But boy, my vacuum cleaner, I got a nice vacuum. Yeah, but don't deal with the symptoms, right? You got to get down to the root issue. It is your sin that needs to be addressed. Secondly, those who claim to be the people of God must take him seriously in all aspects of life, and that includes politics. And that means that as we interact with people on a political level of things, we need to demonstrate Christian wisdom and Christian grace. Right? We need to respond rightly and wisely. Politics, again, are not the end all. They're not the ultimate. Politics are temporary, right? Because there's coming a day when you will no longer vote, right? When the king will rule for 1,000 years. And he's not asking your opinion, right? It's not up for a vote. The Father will establish his Son's kingdom. And we need to be reminded that, yes, we need to be engaged in our culture. We need to be involved in doing what is good for this nation in which God has placed us in temporarily as believers. But ultimately, what? We pray as Jesus taught us, your kingdom come, your will be done. Right? So we must take him seriously in all aspects of life. Thirdly, Yahweh remains sovereign over history. And there's a whole bunch of things that we will never know about history. Right? Now, I would argue that it seems as though we are understanding less and less of history as time progresses. And I'm sure our grandparents and parents thought the same thing about us when we were younger. But it seems like we become more and more ignorant of history as time progresses. And we need to remember that God is sovereign over all aspects of history. And that's why I chuckle at times when you read about different archaeological finds over in the land of Israel. And it's like, it shouldn't surprise us, right? Well, we found this that says something about the house of David. And, well, David was real. Right? Well, you know, we know there's a... there's quite the legend, and there's quite the mythology about... No, David wasn't a myth. He was a real person, right? He has to be, because Messiah comes, what, from the house of David, right? He's the son of David. So Yahweh reigns over history and is sovereign over history. History never takes a detour. History never gets sidetracked. Human history is always going the direction God has designed it to go. There are no mistakes. There are no hiccups. And fourthly, humans may violate commitments they have made, but Yahweh remains true to his word. Now, isn't that, again, what we saw here? Zedekiah makes his promises and then backs out of them. Right? He despises a covenant that was made. Yahweh never breaks his word. Never. Now, I confess I tend to be probably too cynical about politicians and their promises. I'll confess that. I don't trust much of what they have to say. Right? But I know for certain I can trust everything God has said. I never have to be suspicious of what God has said. And what a comfort that is to us in a world where there was a day when, well, you gave your word, right? Or we shook on it, right? When we were younger, it was good enough. We shook on it. That'll do, right? And now we get reams and reams of paper signing and yep. And then we can break that because we want to. Okay? But it used to mean something that you gave your word, you said you would do, you would accomplish that. Humans will violate their commitments that they have made. And perhaps we could reword Daniel Block's statement there and just say, humans will violate commitments they have made. Not just may violate them, but they will. But Yahweh remains true to his word. And you and I can come to this word. It doesn't matter where you read in the Word of God, it is always true. Right? It is always true. God will accomplish what He has communicated here. And what hope that brings to us, and what comfort that brings to us. And even when Israel is in the land of exile, even if they're in Babylon and experiencing the difficulties and the challenges of exile, God is still working. Why? Because God gave His promise. Just because you're experiencing difficulty does not mean that God has, God doesn't do that. But our flesh says, but why has God forgotten me? Right? Sounds like the Psalms, right? But why, it seems like God has made a mistake, or God has forgotten. God has never forgotten. God has never broken His covenant. But people will. And that helps us to balance humanity, right? Yes, we need to be people of our word. Let your yes be yes, your no be no. Right? We're called to that in Scripture. At the same time, we need to remember that people will break their commitment to their agreements. And that doesn't mean we should just expect everybody to lie through their teeth to us. At the same time, we need to be realistic, so that when people do lie to us in their agreements, right? We use that as a reminder to ourselves, I don't ever want to do that, right? I am a Christian. I am a follower of Jesus Christ. I am a child of God, and I need to communicate truth just the way the God of truth communicates with me, right? So keep that. Don't grow overly cynical, but at the same time recognize people have gone astray from the womb speaking lies, right? The Scriptures tell us. So don't be surprised when you get lied to. At the same time, don't lie to people. You ought not to be the one who does the lying. God does not lie. We should not lie, but people will.